Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Pain is a little bit of a mystery. I mean, we all know what it is, and in many cases, we or our medical team can point to a concrete physical injury that's causing our pain. You broke your wrist. That's why your wrist hurts. You had surgery, and your incision point is going to be sore. But the experience of pain is different for different people, and it's hard to describe. You might feel pain more acutely than your friend who has a similar illness or injury, and it can respond differently than your doctor might expect. So treating pain is also complicated. And it's made more complicated now that we all know how potentially dangerous a common treatment method, prescribing opioids, can be. Many doctors say they want to find different ways to treat pain, that opioids are not necessarily even the most effective way to treat the pain, and chronic pain in particular. But patients who rely on this medicine say they're struggling to get it under new guidelines and rules, and they worry that the pendulum shift away from opiates may hurt them, literally. We're going to explore pain management today with Dr. Carlos Pino, Medical Director of the Center for Pain Medicine at the University of Vermont Medical Center, and an anesthesiology professor at the Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Pino, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you provide a better definition than I did of what pain is and why we have it?
Well, pain is a subjective perception of an injury or a potential injury. And the chronicity is given by time. Sometimes, as you mentioned, certain injuries healed, but the pain remains. So being subjective is what provides the mystery to how you treat it. Everybody suffers pain differently. So cure for all types of pain is impossible. So there are different approaches to pain.
So pain is a symptom. Pain is not an illness, or pain is not a diagnosis.
Well, it can become a disease. Chronic pain
is a disease unto itself.
Yeah. So the way our brains work is that the circuitry, just to simplify it, starts creating reverberating signals of the symptom, such that an injury may be healed or a limb may be amputated, but that area, that physical area, is still painful.
We won't go too far down this rabbit hole, but one of the other things that I find fascinating about pain is it doesn't necessarily manifest itself in the place where the injury or illness is. I've had surgery and then had shoulder pain that mm-hmm. was because of the surgery, but it wasn't in the place where the surgery was. I mean, pain sort of it can appear in mysterious places too.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens is that, you know, we're used to thinking of this as a hardwiring, almost like you would build a house. But even though pain is transmitted through nerves primarily, that's not the only way that it's transmitted. And nerves don't have one single start and one single finish. They're plexus, they're branches. So like you say, abdominal pain can be felt in the shoulder. Heart attack pain from your chest can be heard, felt down the arm in different manifestations like this. Back pain can be felt in your leg.
Similarly, can emotional pain be felt as physical pain and vice versa?
Yes, actually, they've done some really good studies looking at the functional images of the brain, and emotional pain lights up the same areas as physical pain.
So that must make it difficult. As you said, there's no one-size-fits-all pain, so there's no one-size-fits-all treatment for pain. Are doctors who are not as steeped in pain management as you are trained well enough to interpret pain in their patients and prescribe accordingly?
Well, I think the education in pain has certainly improved over the years, and the more we know, the more this is carried down to the basic sciences. Medical students over their training receive education on nerve pathways, transmission pathways, how pain signals are carried through, and then in their clinical rotations, they experience it everywhere, not only in the pain clinic rotations, but in anesthesia, in surgery, in primary care. So yeah, there's enough learning. The problem is that once you sit in front of a patient, it is that one patient that you're dealing with. So you take your experience, you take your learning, and you try to apply it to that one patient.
Yeah, and for the patient, on the patient side of things, many people will now be familiar with the pain chart from 1 to 10 and the different smiley faces that you, you know, you look at, and a doctor or a nurse will say, how much pain do you feel? And I've always found that so difficult to diagnose in myself. What am I, an 8? Am I a 6? Maybe it depends on the moment, and I don't know what to compare it to. Maybe I've never felt a 10. So I think this is a 9, but really it's a 6.
Right. The pain scale was a very silly attempt to objectivize something that's very subjective. It really doesn't have a lot of utility because everybody's different, and you can't make something as subjective as pain fit a number.
But is it better than nothing?
I'm not sure it is better than nothing. I actually would argue that it would be better to do a functional evaluation of a person than actually to get a number, to ask him, are they able to walk? Are they able to play with their grandchildren? That's much more useful to me than if they tell me their pain is a 6 out of 10.
This may seem like a simplistic question, but let's take it anyway. If pain is most often a symptom of something else, why do we treat pain specifically rather than just treat the illness or the injury that's causing it? And we actually got a note on this from Paul, who says, I interpret pain management as being another way of saying symptom management. There are many situations in which people complain of having pain, but no source or cause is identified, and yet the reported symptom gets addressed with a medication. And Paul says, I believe that if more effort was put in upfront to verify the existence of a physical condition necessitating the need for prescription pain medication, the physical condition could be addressed and hopefully eliminated, and removing the need to address the symptoms with prescription medication. So why do we treat for pain?
So that's a great question. Pain is a symptom, but like I said earlier, it can also become its own disease. And the diagnosis of pain based on structural changes, it doesn't necessarily correlate. And an example of that is how commonly disease is diagnosed through imaging that doesn't really present any symptoms. There are various studies that show that if you image people's back that don't have any pain, you'll find that they have degenerative disc disease. Yet some folks have degenerative disc disease and have pain. So making the analogy of finding something wrong and that must be the cause of your pain is what has led us, I think, in many ways astray.
But nonetheless, we do often treat for pain and with good reason, right? I mean, if you don't treat for pain, what can happen to a person? I mean, some might say pain can't kill you. The thing that's causing it might, but pain can kill you. I mean, it can lead you to make decisions that might kill you.
It interferes with your life. I mean, I'm not sure if you've had that experience, but once pain becomes chronic, it interferes with your life. It interferes with your family. It interferes how the circle around views you and how you function, how you're able to go to work. So yes, it has a big effect on people in the sense that we can improve people's well-being by managing that symptom or that chronic manifestation of pain, then we are doing something to help them. But yes, it can have that effect.
Let's get right to opioids, because this is an area of focus in pain management and also in the public sphere, and lots of different listener comments coming in on this question of opiates and how they're used and when they're used and when it's appropriate. When is using an opioid medication appropriate for pain?
Oof, that's a tough question. Opioids have been around for many, many years. If you look back 30 years ago, physicians were very frightened of using opioids because of all the side effects that we now know that were true and we knew back then. The problem is that some data that showed that this could potentially help in certain non-cancer pain situation was presented, and people in their intent of helping patients with non-cancer pain started using opioids. And that just flared out of proportion. I think that opioids are very good analgesics. That being the case, they have very severe side effects, death being one of them.
And when you say analgesic, just so we're all on the same page, analgesic meaning
pain relievers. Yeah. So and that has led to what we have now. There are some we've seen over the years. There are some diseases that don't respond well to opioids, and there are some that do. That being said, the risk versus the benefit of a therapy, whether it's opioids or a surgery or an intervention, needs to be assessed in that one patient.
Generally speaking, are opiates more appropriate or more effective in certain types of pain, acute pain, chronic pain?
Yeah. So opioids, according to the data we have, opioids work very well in acute somatic pain, meaning that if you broke an arm or you just had a surgery, opioids work very well in that setting. Less so in chronic pain. And there's really no data to look at chronic use of opioids beyond a year. Most of the data looks at less than that. And that's a problem with studies themselves. But also we've seen in clinical practice that opioids over the long term don't necessarily help and they produce more harm. One of those being worsening pain. So patients that are taking opioids for chronic pain can end up having more pain. But in the acute setting, after a surgery, after an injury, opioids are very good analgesics.
We got a note from Tammy, who wrote to us to share a personal story. And Tammy says her husband had chronic pain from interstitial cystitis and was on high doses of opioids for 10 years. But his doctor weaned him off the opioids altogether over the course of a couple of years. And Tammy says that her husband's pain spiked. He became really unstable. His doctor referred him to a local methadone clinic, but she says they declined to treat him because he wasn't an addict. And a year ago, yesterday, he committed suicide. And Tammy writes, he's not the only one. Many chronic pain patients are being suddenly severely tapered or weaned completely from their life-saving opioid therapy. My question is, why is the symptom of pain being marginalized? Unmanaged pain can lead to death from suicide, cardiac issues, and many other health issues that come as a result of unmanaged pain. What can we do to better serve chronic pain patients in this country?
Yeah, so that's just one example of what can happen when these patients are not adequately treated. Whether the opioids or not were helping the pain, it's really not the question. It's what other therapies are there available for patients that are suffering this type of intervention? And that's why it's so important to reach out to who your physician is and ask him to see a specialist. There are plenty of alternatives out there that can help, maybe not completely eliminate the pain, but manage it in a more effective manner.
And Tammy, I want to say I'm very sorry for your experience and for your husband's experience. But Tammy says her husband's doctor said, there's nothing more I can do for you. Go to the methadone clinic. And that was the end of it with that mm-hmm. relationship with the doctor. So how can a patient advocate for himself or herself when they feel like maybe they're not getting treatment that they need?
I think requesting to see a specialist would be a good start.
Let's go to Christina calling in from Burlington. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Pino, my name is Christina. I'm a fourth-year medical student at the University of Vermont, and I'm applying into anesthesiology with the intention of pursuing a fellowship in both pain medicine as well as addiction medicine, because I see the need for addiction specialists through anesthesia and pain as filling in the void, working specifically with addicts and chronic pain issues that the primary care setting might not be able to provide. And I'm hoping that you can comment on how pain specialists with an understanding of addiction could potentially fill in this void.
Well, Christina, that's a great question, and I look forward to seeing you in the hospital. The knowledge in chronic pain and the management of opioids it's very useful when you are transitioning patients who may have addiction issues, whether it's in the hospital setting or in the outpatient setting. That being said, it's not the only aspect that needs to be managed. A lot of the patients who are addicts, as you well know, will need tremendous psychological support and mental health support. And that, I think, is something that we also need to approach. Primary care doctors have been doing a really good job, and our hub-and-spoke system that we have in Vermont has been doing a really good job at managing some of the addiction components as well. But I think pain physicians are well-positioned to support and help the management of patients who have become addicted to opioids.
When we talk about the opioid addiction problem in the state and in the country, and how often it has been something that started from a legitimate pain prescription. Do you know the numbers on that? And in Vermont in particular, how many people became addicted based on a prescription for opioids that they got from their doctor for a legitimate reason?
So the percentage of addiction, we know very, very little about what the exact percentage is of people that become addicted. We know that chronic pain is a big problem. The Institute of Medicine in 2011 came up with a number, depending on the range, percentage between 25 and 35%. They estimated about 100 million adults in the United States suffering from chronic pain not related to cancer. That's more than cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer combined. So we're talking about massive numbers. If you take that 30% to Vermont, we're talking about 100 and 150,000 people that suffer from chronic pain. That being said, not all those people take opioids.
Also, some people had acute short-term pain and were prescribed opioids.
And
that may have led to addiction from.
Yeah. So one of the evidence we've seen in the last 5 years, for example, is that when patients who are opioid naive, who've never taken an opioid, are prescribed an opioid for a short surgery, for example, they have a higher likelihood of using opioids a year out. So if you look at those same patients a year out, they have a higher likelihood of having, again, consume opioids for whatever reason, not necessarily an addiction. The trend tends to be of a stronger opioid. So there is the more we know about this, the more we understand the impact of an acute prescription. So right now, as of July 1st, the Department of Health here in Vermont has new guidelines in terms of prescribing for acute pain after surgery, where they limit the number of pills. And I think, in that sense, Vermont has been at the forefront trying to do some evidence-based recommendations in terms of what we need to do and how our impact in our day-to-day practice in acute pain can affect the chronic pain being of these people.
We got a note from Steve who says, I had a small cyst removed by a general surgeon in Bennington last year. He gave me a prescription for 15 OxyContin. All I needed was 2 Tylenol. That means there were 15 OxyContin in someone's hands who didn't need them for pain. How many other instances are of this kind of unnecessary and dangerous prescribing? And when will the medical profession begin to do something to stop this practice? Now, Dr. Pino, as you mentioned, there are new guidelines that have more recently than Steve's experience gone into effect that limit the number of pills a patient is allowed to have for certain conditions and for that first prescribing experience. Nonetheless, if the limit is 7 and you're given 7, but really you don't need any, then you're still being overprescribed.
Right. So what Steve mentioned in his note is precisely the case, what used to happen. And that's the intent behind these new guidelines. If you look at the data, more than half of the people who abuse opioids obtain them from a friend. So they were not prescribed to them. That means there are a lot of pills left over somewhere in someone's medicine cabinet. And that comes precisely from situations like this. So what the state recommendations are is that they try to categorize, or they leave it up for the physicians to categorize the amount of pain that you are expected to have, and then they impose some limits. Some of the data shows that precisely doing that, and some of the studies have shown that you're able to reduce, obviously, prescribing. But I think an important part that's missing is educating the public about why we're doing this, what to do with the unused opioids that are left, because inevitably, you'll either prescribe too much or you prescribe too little. And the other side of the coin is those patients who have more pain, because this is not a one-size-fits-all, will end up needing more and being in trouble. So if you do prescribe a reasonable number but patients have a little bit left over, what do you do with the extra opioids? And those are the things, the message we need to get across. So every state has been different about it. But from my last information is that there's some police stations that can actually collect the remaining pills that you can bring and destroy them. There is once a year, there is this drug roundup that is done throughout the country. So there are instances where people can return their pills. And I would encourage you to get them out of the house. Having pills in your house, if you have kids, is dangerous. If people know you have pills in the house, is dangerous. Don't leave them there if you don't need it.
I'm Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition. And today we're talking with Dr. Carlos Pino, Medical Director of the Center for Pain Medicine at the University of Vermont Medical Center. We're talking about pain management and getting a lot of questions and comments from you. Mindy is calling in from Londonderry. Hi, Mindy. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm so glad you guys are having this conversation. First of all, people like the last caller that called in, for every one of him, there are people that who get the seven need twice that much. And if you ask for it, you are treated as though you are a drug addict. And how do we address that problem since everybody's pain is subjective?
Mindy, can I ask you if this is something that you have personal experience with for yourself or others? I mean, is this coming from a personal place or an anecdotal place for you?
It is. It's. I had surgery for kidney stones several years ago, and I was given 20 oxycodones with the instructions to take one or two every 4 to 6 hours. And to get through that pain where I could just sit and not want to scream, I had to take 4 to 5 every 8 hours or so. It was horrible. And when I went back to the emergency room, they, you know, treated me horribly, like I was abusing them. But I was I was praying that I could be in labor for a week rather than having to go through this for another hour. It was horrible.
Mindy, I appreciate you sharing your personal perspective because it's helpful sometimes to hear, you know, what are you talking about when you say this? So, Dr. Pino, what do you think about somebody like Mindy who's saying, maybe the pendulum has swung too far and these guidelines are actually making people with legitimate pain needs where opioids could be effective be treated like they're medication seeking?
So, Mindy, thank you for your question. As we said earlier, whenever you try to set up a sort of mold of how you treat patients, you run into trouble because people are not all cut the same. They're not, they don't have the same experiences. And just like Mindy may have needed more opioids for that condition, there's some people who need less. And it's very hard to predict. We try our best during our initial assessment to say, okay, well, how much do we expect that you will need? But you also have to bear in mind that these medications are dangerous. And when you're prescribed one pill every 4 hours and you take 2 or 3 pills every 4 hours, you're running the risk of dying. And that is very, very concerning to whoever is prescribing the medication. So I think if you're in a situation like that, the most important thing is to reach out to the physician who is treating you. Make sure you have a good relationship with that physician and discuss with them. Look, this is not cutting it. I need to have a little extra. Should I take something else? Is there something stronger that may help? So that open communication will avoid all of this bad sentiment and perceptions from people. Because if your physician or your nurse practitioner who's prescribing actually sees that you're struggling with this, they may be much more likely to understand what you're going through than if somebody who doesn't know you sees you coming to the emergency room and looks at the record and you've consumed X number of pills in half of the time that you were supposed to consume.
All of that advice seems good and thoughtful. You said it will remove all perceptions or all problems that people think that you're drug seeking if you have a relationship with your doctor and you go to your doctor. Can that really be true? I mean, isn't there a case to be made that at least for some patients, maybe the pendulum has swung too far? And, you know, doctors who in a good effort to provide the best care for their patients may go too far on the other side and not prescribe when it may be helpful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that is a risk with this. And the reality is that doctors are human beings. They have their license and their life at risk. And when all these guidelines, which are done with the best intention, put some limits, stepping beyond those guidelines puts them at risk. And that's why that relationship is so important, because if a doctor is going to go out on a limb for you to try to help you, then you need to be very straightforward with that doctor and be very open so that things are documented. The way we are judged is by our results.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to, 23 or 24 years ago, I had some reconstructive surgery on my ankle for a skiing injury, and was told by the orthopedic surgeon at the University of Vermont, don't get fit. This is the literal conversation we had. Don't get physical therapy. It puts money in other people's pockets. Here's your jug of Oxy, whatever it was that he gave me. And, you know, in short order, I was an addict, ruined my life. I wound up cross-medic. I didn't know I was an addict until I detoxed by myself. And you know, I wound up cross-medicating with alcohol for years. And it's far better, I think, to have somebody be in a lot of pain than it is to have somebody become a drug addict because they weren't in pain. And very few people die from pain, but a lot of people die from opiates.
John, I appreciate your perspective and appreciate you sharing your personal story with us. Dr. Pino, John says it's better to be in pain than to be an addict.
Yeah, John, thank you for your story. That, unfortunately, has happened plenty of times, that we prescribe too many medications in patients to become addicted. It's hard to anticipate who will become an addict. That being said, I have often worked with people who are now taking medications for many, many years. And one of the challenges that I struggle with is having patients understand what you understood, that you can come off the medications and your pain will be there, but in reality won't be much worse than what you're facing with now. And your life, your perception of function and your day-to-day will be much better. So there is a very good argument for patients who have been on opioids for a long time to try to wean off those opioids, because they will find that their pain is not necessarily that much worse. People do become tolerant to opioids, so at some point they stop working.
Let's, John makes a comparison there. It's better to be in pain than to be an addict. And let's leave that comparison to the side. And not be trying to compare those things. But chronic pain, as you've said, can be debilitating. It can ruin your quality of life. Tammy wrote in earlier and said her husband was in so much pain and so unstable that he took his own life because of it. So chronic pain is just horrific for many people who go through it. So, you know, again, leaving this question of opiate addiction to the side, I know we're not getting rid of it, but leaving it to the side, do we have a problem with pain in this country, and how do we deal with it for people who feel pain that really, really impacts their lives?
Well, one of the key things to, again, go back and consider is that pain is a very subjective thing. At some point, pain becomes a disease. How it becomes a disease, we don't really know. Different cultures experience pain very differently. So the fact that you mentioned about how we experience pain in this country may be something to that. That being said, most developed countries have similar issues. As as we stop worrying about our day-to-day survival, you know, as become richer countries, then we start worrying about other things that affect us. You know, and chronic pain is something that if you're battling to put food in the table, you may be able to look and deal with your back pain. But, you know, if you have a good job and you have an expectation that you shouldn't suffer because of this back pain, you want something done. You have the time, you have the need to look into it. So is there a cultural perception to this? Is there a well-being perception to this? I think pain affects people differently. And there are some people who tolerate a lot of pain, and there are some folks that don't. And it's very hard to criticize either way.
Let's go to Leslie, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. So, actually, I'm going to change up my question a little bit based on what you guys just said. Initially, my comment was going to be about alternative therapy for pain management, which is out of control cost-wise for most people. Most people can't afford massage therapy daily or even weekly or acupuncture. And these things actually do work for pain management. I have a couple of chronic illnesses. I have a very high tolerance for pain, so I've never had to succumb to opiates. But I do deal with pain every day, and it is expensive to deal with. And it is something that I can't afford. Most of the time, insurance companies don't cover it because they would much rather pay for a $2 pill.
Leslie, let's take up that topic. And Dr. Pino, what about that? I mean, if you're a patient who has limited resources and there may be things like massage therapy, like acupuncture that have been proven to help with pain, or other treatments that are not something that your insurance is going to pay for, you know, aren't we missing the boat in this country?
Well, I think you have a point, Leslie. Thank you for bringing that up. I think there are a lot of other therapies that can be used, whether it's things we do in a pain clinic, like interventional therapies, that some of them are covered by insurance, a lot of them are not. Or you use alternative medicines like acupuncture or massage therapy. Most of them are not covered by insurance. Yes, there are a lot of things that can be done. But it's not only the insurance aspect or the financial aspect. You could also bring this up to a geographical aspect. If you live in a part of Vermont where you don't have access to these therapies, you have the same problem. So, yes, it is much easier for pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies to find a pill that will work and maybe pay for that. But the reality is that there's a lot more to managing pain than just the pill. And there are a lot of things out there that have really, really good evidence. The problem is that we struggle with payment in those. And whether it's in classic medical therapies that don't get reimbursed or alternative therapies that don't get reimbursed. And I really don't have a good solution. What I can say is that the University of Vermont is working to create that sort of therapy. So I would expect hear some good news over the next 6 months to hopefully a year.
So is this something like as hospitals like UVM Medical Center turn away from fee-for-service and towards more holistic ideas of patient treatment, that something like massage therapy, something like exercise groups might actually be included in sort of inside the hospital setting or inside a medical setting where a patient doesn't necessarily have to pay for that? I mean, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, the reimbursement and the payment model, certainly it's appropriate in that sense when you talk about population-based reimbursement. That being said, though, there is a whole trend that we're seeing in society to move into this alternative therapy models. And I think that's really what's been the driver here. We recognize there are other things that need to be covered. Mental health, it's an important component of pain, and unfortunately, we have very few mental health providers in the state. So there are a lot of things that we can do, and we are doing our best to approach that appropriately.
Let's go to Dick calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm here pulled off the side of the road because I don't want to say I'm incensed of the discussion, but I have a question to the presenter. I don't remember his name or his position, but has he ever experienced real severe debilitating pain? You know, when you say pain is subjective, I've got 3 ruptured discs, okay? I got facets disease. I go to have procedures done, and the insurance company replies back that, you know, as long as opiates are effective, that's the course of treatment. Now, I have been on and off opiates for about 10 years. The problem is, from both perspectives, that the opiate allows me to work. I work on a farm. And the alternative, which is surgery, if it's approved by the insurance company, is I got a 6-month recovery period.
I'm going to stop you there, and because you ask important questions, and I want to turn it to Dr. Pino. And the first one was, have you ever experienced severe pain? But also, you know, Dick says it's angering to hear somebody describe pain as subjective, but you know, subjective doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt for that person.
Absolutely. I do have a chronic pain condition. That's what actually drove me to the medical field. But subjective, you're absolutely right. It doesn't mean that it's in your head. It does not mean that it's non-existent. It means that every patient should be treated with respect and individually.
So how do you deal with people who get angry at this topic? Because, you know, as you said, it's different for everybody and, you know, different treatments and different prescriptions and, you know, people who are experiencing something personally or when you talk about cultural differences, you know, may say, hey, I need help for my pain. And as somebody who heads up the Center for Pain Medicine, that must be something you're sympathetic to.
Oh, absolutely. We see this all the time. But, you know, again, it's a conversation that we need to have one-on-one. It's very hard to explain it on the air. This is all about having a relationship, having empathy, and working together.
Dr. Carlos Pino is medical director of the Center for Pain Medicine at the University of Vermont Medical Center. He also teaches at the Lerner College of Medicine. Thank you very much for talking about pain management with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.